Many of you know that this talk show is just one of several hats that I wear. As president of the Institute for Public Affairs of Montreal, which is one of Canada's largest social advocacy alliances, we deal with matters of social justice. We advocate on matters of social justice, whether they're for the homeless, whether they're for the poor, whether they're for the hungry, or whether it's about freedom. We don't believe that social justice stops at our borders. We push that agenda in our magazine called Barricades, and we push it on this show. And I've been very clear about that. This is not a show about political correctness. This is a show that pushes an agenda of social justice at home and abroad. And I've spent much time the past several weeks on the Mideast crisis. I've been very clear in my views. This is not just democratic Israel's struggle. This is the free world struggle. Israel is merely the frontline nation in this world war against a theocratic tyranny. A tyranny that seeks to impose a hegemony over the liberal West. I won't debate that point. I take the Al-Qaeda's, the Hezbollah's, and the Hamas's at their word. I've been flooded with supportive emails and calls from across the country. Most of you get it. You understand that the heinous killings and provocations of the jihadists and their fellow travelers are those of fascists, not freedom fighters. That they hate us for what we do right, live free, not for anything we do wrong. But some of you good Canadians are upset, very upset. You consider my position somewhat un-Canadian. Who knows? Maybe one day you politically correct Lilliputians out there may get your wish and get me thrown off the air. But for now, I know that I offend some of your delicate sensibilities. You don't like to believe that in this world of instant communication and instant destruction, there really is evil. It's not all gray all the time. You'd like me to have a more proportional position. You'd like me to share your sunshine patriot moral relativism, your fawning, chattering class notions of every culture's right to be wrong, your knee-jerk anti-Americanism, and most of all, your fashionably smug Canadian political equivalency that masks nothing less than a cowardice to confront murder and mayhem. Well, I decided today that I certainly wouldn't want to be responsible for any neurotic breakdowns among you fey and feckless out there. So as your humble servant, I'll offer the following apology, inspired by a letter from retired Marine Corps General Charles Pittman, from whom I've liberally borrowed in some places, and please don't get your knickers in a knot that I had the audacity to draw inspiration from an American. I will say I'm sorry about the following. I'm sorry that it hasn't been recognized, to Canada's credit, that almost every recent Canadian military engagement where we sent the best of our youth into harm's way was in the defense of Muslims in peril, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, in the Persian Gulf, in Kuwait, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. Yes, we were there too, and the list goes on. I'm sorry that so few Canadians demanded an apology from Islamist extremists and their state supporters after 9/11 and after all the other atrocities from London to Madrid, Bali to Beslan, Jerusalem to Amsterdam. I am sorry that most Arabs and Muslims have to live in squalor under savage dictatorships. I am sorry that their leaders squander their wealth. I am sorry that their governments breed hate for the West and their religious schools, mosques, and government-controlled media, and that Canada, until recently, sent foreign aid to the Palestinian authorities that allowed it to produce textbooks propagating hate against Israel and the West. I am sorry that so few Canadians know that Israel was the only state to recognize the Arab state of Palestine in 1948, while Palestine's neighboring Arab cousin states attacked Israel and occupied Palestine, keeping its territory hostage after an aggressive war for 20 years, never allowing it independence. I am sorry that Canadians do not call for Arab apologies. I am sorry that so many of you deny to Israel, which holds territories acquired after a defensive war in the same manner as France, Russia, and America did until peace was achieved, the same rights as those nations had under international law. I am sorry that so many do not recognize that even under Israeli occupation, Palestinians have the lowest infant mortality, highest medical services, and the largest percentage of university students of any frontline Arab jurisdictions. I am sorry that the U.S. and Israel are the biggest financial supporters of poverty-stricken Arabs, while the insanely wealthy Arab neighboring states contribute token amounts and blame those self-same supporters for all the troubles in the Middle East. I am sorry that Jordan kicked out the PLO into South Lebanon in 1970, that Egypt has imprisoned over 40,000 members of the violent Muslim Brotherhood over the past few years, and that even Saudi Arabia has now denounced Hezbollah, and yet much of our own media demands that Israel must suffer assaults on its people without response. I am sorry that successive governments of Lebanon have failed the brave Lebanese who made the Cedar Revolution to be free, but have been betrayed at every turn by weak leaders who allow everything from the arming of homicidal gangs from the PLO in the 80s to Hezbollah today and succumb on bended knee to the dictates of Syria and Iran. I am sorry that UN Secretary General Kofi Annan failed to protect the poor of Iraq from the oil-for-food money scam in which he protected his own son's involvement and now seeks moral absolution because a UN outpost was accidentally attacked instead of being pulled out earlier, as all UN observers had been in 67, 73, and 82. I am sorry that Annan failed the people of Lebanon in refusing to send in 10,000 combat-ready troops into South Lebanon to control Hezbollah, as was required by Resolution 1559, just as he failed the people of Rwanda in refusing to give UN peacekeeping commander Canadian General Romeo Dallaire the necessary assets and authority to stop the genocide in Rwanda, as he was mandated to do by Resolution 1441 when Annan was the UN official responsible for peacekeeping operations. I am sorry that our own left wing, our media, and so many of our own brainwashed masses do not understand any of this and fail to recognize that the courage of Prime Minister Harper's principled resolve is restoring Canadian pride, purpose, and consequence on the world stage alongside our traditional allies in the family of free nations. I am sorry that Prime Minister Harper, initially facing derision for questioning the UN's failures, was proven correct when he asked why the observers weren't pulled out at the start of the conflict. I am sorry that here in Canada, Her Majesty's loyal opposition in the person and party of Bill Graham and the Liberals are of such low limitation and narrow circumstance that they can only oppose for the sake of their political opportunism and not propose for the sake of the progress of freedom. And when they are proven wrong, they refuse to apologize. I am sorry that some Arab governments encourage homicide bombers by paying their families $20,000 upon their deaths. I am sorry that those same bombers are brainwashed thinking they will receive 72 virgins in paradise. I am sorry that Hezbollah and their allied gangs of thugs think pregnant women, babies, children, the elderly, and other non-combatant civilians are legitimate targets to kill and legitimate human shields to use. I am sorry that so many in our country think it is legitimate, put aside proportionate, of Hezbollah to invade Israel, kill 8 soldiers, kidnap 2 others, ostensibly in order to bargain for the release of Hezbollah and Hamas thugs imprisoned in Israel for murder and terror. By that standard, any criminals here at home should be allowed to kill and kidnap cops as hostages in return for the release of their fellow criminal friends in Canadian prisons. I am sorry that Israel is vilified because it has suffered less casualties in this current conflict, because it protects its most vulnerable instead of exploiting them. I am sorry that in the 21st century, our troops must still defend Arab women against gang rape, beheadings, and stonings that they are subjected to from retrograde and revanchist religious laws that should have died with the Dark Ages. I am sorry that Muslim extremists have killed more Arabs than they have any other people, and that continues in Lebanon for those who think Hezbollah exercises its stranglehold over the south only through dispersing some $100 million of Iranian money. Most of the money goes for arms and training. Most of its control comes from its homebred Murder Incorporated. Al Capone had nothing on these guys. I am sorry that foreign-trained terrorists are trying to seize control of Iraq and return it to a terrorist state. I am sorry that Hamas betrays the Palestinian people with a refusal to renounce violence, thereby stopping the progression of Palestine from de facto to de jure statehood. I am sorry that Hezbollah, Hamas, Al-Qaeda, and all the other terrorist groups always find a convenient holy site to attack from and then demand an apology for those sites being destroyed. I am sorry, as we approach the 5th anniversary of 9/11, that none of them apologize for the collapse of St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church, one of America's holy sites, after ramming jets into the World Trade Center. I am sorry they didn't apologize for Flight 93 and 175, the USS Cole, the embassy bombings, the murders and beheadings of Nick Berg, Daniel Pearl, and all the other atrocities. I am sorry that the brave souls on Flight 93, who so valiantly fought their killers, failed to rip those bastards' hearts out. The free world will get past this absurdity. It will punish those responsible, because that is what we do. We survived the appeasers before. As Churchill said of Chamberlain, he wanted neither war nor Hitler. He got both. The free world hangs out its dirty laundry for the entire world to see. That's what the jihadists can't stand. The light of liberty focused on its wrongs. We hang it out there, fix the problems, and move on. That's one of the reasons we're hated so much. We don't hide this stuff like the rogue Arab states and terror gangs constantly demanding Western apologies. Canadians' compassion must always be tempered with the vivid memories of free nations' troops being killed, mutilated, burnt, thrown out of windows, and stomped on after being taken prisoner, and all this amongst joyous crowds of celebrating Islamists handing out candies and cake in what the media love to call the Arab street. If you want more of an apology from this Canadian, who remembers that tens of thousands of us made the supreme sacrifice for freedom and now lay row on row in fields where poppies grow, you're going to have a long wait. So suck it up. As General Pittman said, you have a better chance of finding those 72. You know, before the rocket attacks, the kidnappings, the 1,000 Qassams rocketing over Gaza into southern Israel, it's Deirot, before the Katushas, before Hezbollah in the north, Israel suffered through over 5,000 homicide bombers, killing thousands, wounding thousands more. Our first guest, a remarkable man, Leo Adler, is a well-known Canadian criminal lawyer, distinguished member of the International Association of Defense Attorneys. In February 2005, Mr. Adler was one of 15 people appointed by the Canadian government to the Cross-Cultural Roundtable on National Security. He's also the Director of National Affairs for the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And for the first time, an NGO was invited to the G8 on the question of crimes against humanity. And in January 2006, Leo Adler was invited by the government of the Russian Federation to be a part of this year's G8, and he was instrumental in getting the NGOs to adopt a resolution condemning suicide bombing and declaring it to be a crime against humanity. We're proud and privileged to have with us Leo Adler from Toronto. Leo, welcome, and thanks for taking the time on a busy Sunday, I know, for you.
Thank you very much, Beryl. And one other apology. I'm sorry that what you said isn't available 24 hours a day on all radio and television stations. I think it should be mandatory reading and hearing.
Thank you very much for that. Leo, this is a historic and a tremendous story of how a Canadian NGO, because you are Director of National Affairs for the Friends of Simon Wiesenthal Center in Canada, managed this back channel to bring this critical humanitarian issue in front of the most powerful countries in the world. How did it start?
It actually started about 3 years ago when we launched the campaign to have suicide bombing declared specifically as a crime against humanity. In a very general fashion, crimes against humanity have been defined by the United Nations, by the International Criminal Court, and so on. But the issue of suicide bombing was such that we felt that there could be absolutely no justification for it. You know the old adage about today's terrorist becoming tomorrow's liberationist and so on. And whatever factuality that may have, in our view, it absolutely does not apply to suicide bombing. You want to make a point, you can make a point in many other ways. You can rebel against perceived illegalities in many ways, but not through suicide bombing. So we started an international campaign, and actually one of the very first meetings Rabbi Cooper, who's our associate dean, had with the late Pope. And coincidentally, the next day...
That's Abraham Cooper from Los Angeles, right?
That's correct. And coincidentally, the next day, the Pope met with various Muslim leaders and told them, in his elliptical way, about the sanctity of life. But we felt that this had to be politically confronted. And there is actually another remarkable man... I proposed this as a resolution to the Canadian Parliament. Stockwell Day was one of the presenters. Richard Marceau was one of the presenters. And we actually brought it as a resolution.
Richard was a Bloc Québécois
Bloc Québécois member, that's correct. And we also had members from the Liberals and from the NDP as an all-party resolution. And I testified in front of the committee. But unfortunately, the first election that resulted in the Martin minority did not allow for that to be passed. And the Canadian government, the Liberal government, was very reluctant, so I don't think they were unhappy to see this go. There was, however, another person who was very interested in this, and that was the Russian ambassador to Canada. His name is Georgi Mamadov.
And how did he find out about it?
He read about it. And called me and said that this is a fantastic thing, that the Russians, having felt the lash, if you will, of suicide bombings, wanted to discuss it with me. He and I had several meetings, and the upshot of it was that he asked me if I would mind if he nominated me to be on the steering committee of the NGO parallel conferences with the G8. And I said, no, of course not. And so...
Of course not, you didn't mind. Not of course not, don't do it.
I ended up going to Moscow a couple of times over the winter, first as an organizational meeting, and then with some 300 NGOs present. And I linked up with another fellow Canadian by the name of Nigel Martin, who's actually from Montreal, with a Russian lawyer who was very much interested in this, and with a woman who was herself a victim because her one of her kids had died in Beslan in the school massacre that took place over there. And we worked very hard in order to see to it that just the victims of suicide bombing, without getting into finger-pointing about whether or not, for example, the Russian government reacted properly in trying to free the students, or whether or not the British government is giving proper compensation, or whether or not the Canadian government, because Air India was, of course, our first act of terrorism here in Canada, of international terrorism, whether or not there ought to be some form of compensation. The whole emphasis was to talk about the pain and the suffering that victims went through as a result of suicide bombing, and that it was the suicide bombers who were at fault for this, and leaving aside then for each country to resolve its own internal issue, the matter of suicide bombing being a
leaving aside, in other words, leaving aside the politics. We're talking about this is what you cannot do within the guidelines of humanitarian international law.
And every country had its own particular issues of how to deal with it, and we felt that they had to do that on their own.
Leo, please, if you could stay with us during this break, because I want to get back and wrap up with you on what were the backroom discussions and what is the real effect on international legal doctrine, particularly taking into consideration the responsibility to protect. We'll be right back. Montreal, we're back, and you can reach me at info@iapm.ca. We're talking to Leo Adler, Director of National Affairs for the Simon Wiesenthal Center, about the remarkable accomplishment of this NGO in getting the G8 to adopt a resolution calling suicide bombing, or homicide bombing, as I like to call it, a crime against humanity. Leo, with the time we have left, I'd just like to address two questions. Any interesting back-channel discussions? Was there any opposition at the St. Petersburg Summit? And secondly, how does this come into the international legal order? How would it rate, for example, with Canada's sponsorship of the International Commission on State Sovereignty and Intervention coming up with this concept of responsibility to protect?
All right. The first thing is it's not the G8 per se that adopted this, although that will be our next goal for next year's G8.
It's the NGOs.
It's the NGOs. That's correct, which is still remarkable in my view.
Absolutely.
And we had many discussions with the Germans, with Russians, with Canadians, with the French, all the other members of the G8, and our next goal, in fact, is to get it politically passed by the G8 at next year's summit in Germany. As far as moving this on an international level, I think it's clear that there has to be this acknowledgement and recognition of suicide bombing, and in fact, we anticipate and are hoping that there will be a resolution passed through Parliament to start the ball rolling in getting this dealt with as a very specific matter.
Now, this is a matter of resolutions, country by country, Congress by Congress, Parliament by Parliament.
That's what you're going to have to get, but we're hoping to start it off with Canada. I think that Canada is extremely well positioned, especially with this particular government, to do that. I think that the G8, of which Canada, of course, is a member, with the passing of the resolution by the NGOs, hopefully next year the G8 will start, and then from there you go to other regional bodies such as the European Union, such as NATO, such as the Organization of American States and so on, until finally it gets to be truly an international standard.
Was there any resistance for any one of the G8 in particular, or was there for the NGOs, attending the G8?
Yeah.
By sector or by organization?
No. Remarkably, while there was concern about the way, again, when you take it down to the
backroom politics, I'm talking about the alliances that were formed.
Yeah, no, the alliances were clear. People were afraid. They were afraid of what their governments would do in terms of the victims. They were afraid that the victims' rights perhaps wouldn't be accepted. A lot of the NGOs wanted much more specific condemnation of not only suicide bombing, but of the way in which their countries either reacted or didn't react. And I knew that would be a death knell.
Leo Adler,
we tried to just stay on focus.
And I know that your focus made them realize that this is a question of common universalities, not parochial particularities. And we'll be talking again, you and I, and a lot of the backroom stories as this issue develops. Leo Adler, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Montreal, we'll be right back. Montreal, we're back, where we're privileged to be joined by Amir Tahiri, internationally renowned author, perhaps the leading expert on what's going on in Iran, the author of Holy Terror. Amir Tahiri, thanks for joining us today. Thanks for taking the time. I know you're traveling to very, very dangerous places these days.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Amir, you wrote a very interesting column recently in the New York Post, and the opening line was, "When nothing else works, there's always Israel." And you go into a discussion of the interplay between Iran and Syria and Hezbollah and what everybody has to gain. Now, we've heard just before this call that the very attack that Hezbollah had planned and carried out was actually done at the behest of Khaled Meshal, Hamas's political chief based in Damascus, who called the Iranians to have them call Hezbollah to open a second front. Have you heard anything to that effect?
Yes, you know, this has been discussed for a long time, but of course Khaled Meshal is too much of a small fry to have the final say in that. He's just part of the bigger game, which is orchestrated, in fact, by Tehran and Damascus. But the question of a second front has been debated for many, many months. Even before the Palestinian elections, there was sort of a pincer action against Israel by Hezbollah and by Islamic Jihad and Hamas in Palestine.
The interesting question is, why would Hezbollah risk this now? They've been relatively quiescent for so many years. I know through our own phone calls in Lebanon to Muslim and Christian leaders alike, there's almost a feeling of relief that Hezbollah could get wiped out or could have their strategic arsenal severely reduced. Why would Nasrallah, Sheikh Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, take such a risk now?
Well, Nasrallah, I think, miscalculated. You know, last year and early this year, there was a debate within the Hezbollah between those who believe that it was time for Hezbollah to distance itself from the Iranian and Syrian strategy and become a fully-fledged player in the Lebanese politics with two members of the cabinet and 12 members of the parliament and lots of positions in municipalities and so on. At one point, even I felt that Nasrallah might side with those who wanted this. But unfortunately for Hezbollah, Nasrallah is too close to Iran. You know, he's really an independent man. He's not an independent decision maker. And in the bigger scheme of things, he could not play a strategy of distancing Hezbollah from the Islamic Republic. Although in recent years Hezbollah has managed to create a base for itself, it is not as dependent on it as it was before, although now about half of its budget comes from Iran, not 100%, which was the case 10 years ago. So there were many voices within the Hezbollah and in the broader Lebanese Shiite community who didn't think it was wise for Hezbollah to remain entirely dependent on Iran and entirely dependent on the Alawite regime in Syria, which is in any case regarded as enemy of all Islamic ideologies.
This leads to the next question. We understand that Iran has control over Hezbollah and has had for many years. But the Syrian intervention is curious. They pull out of Lebanon. They see that Jordan and Egypt have peace treaties with Israel. They see that even Saudi Arabia this time, not overtly but quietly, condemned the Hezbollah action. What is Assad's game? What's he trying to gain? Is he just trying to be the leader of the last revanchist front left on the frontline states?
Well, you know, again, there was a debate in Syria, which I think was clinched towards the end of last year and early this year. There were those, including many in the entourage of Assad, I know some of them personally, who wanted to persuade him to switch sides. That is to say, to subscribe to the American vision for the Middle East, which is democratization, liberalization, joining the global economy, and so on. And he was tempted to do that. But somehow his closer entourage, members of his family, those you know, who are implicated in the investigation over the murder of former Lebanese yes. Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, prevailed on him. And then there was pressure from Iran. He had a long talk with President Ahmadinejad of Iran, and he decided that Ahmadinejad's analysis is right. Ahmadinejad told Assad that George Bush is an aberration. We have to wait him up for out for another couple of years. Once he's gone, the Americans will run away. The idea of democracy a la American in the Middle East will be dead, and we will emerge as the major powers there. And Assad, like Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, bought into the Iranian strategy. So what we are facing now is a mini version of the Cold War. There are two visions of the Middle East clashing. One is the vision of George Bush, democratization, etc. The other one is the vision of Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies, Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas, and other radical groups here and there. These two visions are clashing in Lebanon today.
Amir Tahiri, please stay with us. We'll be back with you right after this. Montreal, we're back, and we're talking with Amir Tahiri in London. Amir, you were talking in the previous segment about the two different visions in the Middle East. Now, is this sort of a last-gasp effort between regimes like Syria and Iran and groups like Hamas and Hezbollah who really feel that however imperfect, the experiments in democratization have been in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Palestine, in Lebanon, that this is really a door that once open can never be shut, and this is their last gasp to try to reverse the tide?
Yes, you know, what we have to realize is that none of these players in the game, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Islamic Republic or Syria, they are not monolithic. Within each of them, there are people who understand that this policy of adventurism and this idea that you can create an Islamic superpower led by Iran based on the Middle East oil, based on the demography, the number of millions of young people who are ready to fight and die, and so on. All these, you know, vision that Ahmadinejad has been promoting, there are people in each camp who do not subscribe to this vision. But for the time being, they have lost the debate. You know, they at the moment, the hardliners, the most radical elements are there. They think in this tug of war, the Americans will hesitate, will back down because President Bush is unpopular in his own country. His political opponents are not ready to give him any support at all, and so on. Another danger from the point of view of the American vision is that even Israel is now being seen as if it is fighting an American-style war, which means aerial bombardments without going to fight on the ground. You know, and this Americanization of Israel is also a point that the hardliners make much of in their debate. They say Israel, too, is becoming soft. Israel, too, is becoming like the U.S. and Western Europe.
Yet Israel has crossed the border into Lebanon, even though it's a limited operation.
Yes, but, you know, they compare it with 1982, you know, when
yes.
the Israelis came with hundreds of tanks and
yes.
the thousands of troops and so on. And don't forget, you know, I was listening to the Tehran radio today, and their main theme is that all the Arab armies in 1967 could not resist Israel for 6 days. And Hezbollah has been fighting Israel for more than 10 days now, and the Israelis have not been able to get an inch of territory, and still they say we haven't managed to stop Hezbollah from firing rockets at us. You know, so the perceptions sometimes are more important than reality.
Even though Israel said they didn't want territory, they just wanted to destroy the infrastructure.
Yes, but you know, this is not understood from the other side. The other side does not understand these niceties. You know, even
right.
if suppose I tell you this, and suppose Israel goes and destroys all the missiles of Hezbollah and so on, but still, you know, its leadership is intact. Sheikh Nasrallah appears on television, makes a speech. By not losing, by staying alive, he would claim victory. You know, have you forgotten Saddam Hussein?
Absolutely.
You know, who went around for 13 years after being expelled from Kuwait and claimed that he has won a heroic victory over the United States.
These
are the perceptions.
So in order to really close the infrastructure gap and destroy the materiel and the assets that Hezbollah has, part of the mission has got to be to get rid of Nasrallah.
Yes, or at least, you know, create the conditions in which his opponents inside Hezbollah can get rid of him.
And
He has opponents within the party who think he's leading Lebanon and Hezbollah to disaster.
And I want to close on these two points, because you made a very important point in your paper that Hezbollah's traditional allies, Nabi Berri, leader of the more moderate Shiite Amal movement, and General Michel Aoun, who's a Maronite, who signed an alliance with Nasrallah, they're not supporting him right now.
Nobody is supporting him. Even, you know, I have had several telephone calls from members of leading Shiite families who say this man is leading us to ruin on behalf of Iran. Nobody in Lebanon wants to fight Israel, because the Lebanese were rebuilding their lives. You know, they were regaining confidence in future. Things were going rather well for them. The Syrians were out of their country. They were beginning to breathe. And suddenly, you know, as if all this is canceled. Why? Because Mr. Nasrallah wants to hijack Lebanon on behalf of Iran, which needs to divert attention from its own nuclear ambitions.
That was half my last question. My last question was a two-part question. Iran gains from this because they got themselves knocked off as the number one item on the G8, which I know you just came back from.
Yes.
And does Assad win anything by diverting attention from his implication in the Hariri assassination?
Yes. Now, if you listen to his ambassadors who are being interviewed on radios all over the place, he's saying that, you know, there can't be any peace in the Middle East without Syria. And, you know, you have to talk to me. Condoleezza Rice is coming to the Middle East. She must come and see me. Of course, I hope she wouldn't, you know, like previous American Secretaries of State. He wants to come back into this play by saying that, you see, if you don't talk to me, if you exclude me from the process, if you think of regime change in Damascus,
we
are going to run into this kind of trouble.
We'll continue with blood.
Yeah.
Amir Tahiri from London, thank you very much. I know you've just come back from the G8, and your further travels will be even more interesting. And I wish you safe travels, and we will talk to you upon your return.
Thank you very much.
Or email me at info@iapm.ca. Now, the breaking news from the Middle East this morning, as many of you might have heard, has been the shelling of a town called Qana in southern Lebanon, which resulted in the collapse of a building and civilian casualties. This is another one of those stories that really irks me, because Israel has always held to the standard of having to explain everything that happens, while Hezbollah shelling of civilian areas on purpose, not by exception but by rule, is just waved away as their right to express themselves. Now, what is interesting this morning is the Brigadier General James Marks, who is the CNN military analyst, has explained that that building was not hit, but there were, according to him, between 4 to 6 Hezbollah sites around it that were being targeted, and the vibrations from those explosions collapsed the building. To shed some more light on this, we're privileged to have with us Israeli Consul General in Montreal, Mark Attali. Mark, good morning. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Yeah, good morning. Good afternoon, in fact.
Good afternoon. I'm sorry. What's the latest that you've heard?
Well, first of all, Bro,
let me say that we deeply regret the loss of innocent life in this ongoing war against Hezbollah terrorism. And it's unfortunate that human life, civilian life are being lost. Look, the army is still investigating exactly what happened last night and this morning. There's one thing which is there's no doubt about it, that Kfar Kana was really a stronghold of Hezbollah. Just to say a few figures, in the recent days there were 150 rockets launched from the area of Kfar Kana, from within the village and the surrounding village. And you know, in order to launch such a quantity of rockets, you really need a very, very strong infrastructure. And basically what Kfar Kana was, as I said, a stronghold of Hezbollah. Now,
and indeed we have film of rockets indeed we have film of rockets being sent out of Kfar Kana. In other buildings, not in this building.
Well, there are a lot of the military air force has a lot of videos that were just published in a press conference in Tel Aviv this afternoon, in which you can see a building, not this particular building, but how rockets are being launched from approximately from a building, and then other videos that shows exactly rockets being launched from Kfar Kana, while you see a truck that was carrying the rockets after the launching of the rockets going into the village in order to hide among the houses.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I got a copy of that early this morning. So if any of you listeners want to see it, I'll be glad to email it out to you. Go ahead, Mark.
Yes, but one thing I want to make clear. The targets that the Air Force is bombarding right now, I can assure you one thing, that they're really doing everything to avoid casualty. Unfortunately, in this ongoing war, there are also sometimes mistakes, but however, if the army is investigating on that. Well, the area was bombed a couple of times this night. And in this particular area where the building was, there was a bombing in something like 1 o'clock in the morning, and then the building collapsed around 8 o'clock in the morning, according to the Israeli military.
Some 6 hours later.
So they're investigating what exactly happened there, because in the morning there was another attack in the area of the village, but there were other targets that were hit, and in fact, it was proven by the military videos that those targets was selected and hit, and I'm not talking now about this particular building. So there's an investigation that is going on. But again, the problem is that we see again how Hezbollah cynically used those populated areas by civilians in order to launch rockets against Israel. We see that they don't hesitate to hide among the civilians. They don't hesitate to launch the rockets and then run into the village. And this is what it says in all of this situation. And it proves once and for all that we have to end up the terrorism of Hezbollah. We have to stop Hezbollah's capabilities to launch terror attacks against Israel, because unfortunately, hatred will continue, and innocent people on both sides will gonna have to go, and we're gonna have again to pay the price of these hostilities of Hezbollah. So, again, there's nothing that the military is doing that is not under really a microscope in order to understand all the military operation. Everything has been filmed, everything has been documented, and as soon as the inquiry, the investigation of the military on this issue will be completed, all the facts will be known and also will be published. But again, one thing is clear. We are not in a war against the Lebanese people, and it is unfortunate that Lebanese innocent civilians are losing their life. However, we're in a war against Hezbollah, and cynically is using the Lebanese as a human shield. And that's the unfortunate situation.
Mark Attali, Consul General of Israel in Montreal, I thank you for your time. And with our next guest, we're going to be discussing the restrictions under which the Israeli Defense Forces are operating to take care of not hurting civilians. Mark, have a good... We always have a lot of talk about the geopolitical consequences of the war in the Middle East, the broad philosophical outlines, but there's a human face to this war. And the human face is not always presented in the media in equal fashion. And our next guest has just had a chance to look at that human face from a unique perspective on the ground. Aaron Reamer is National Chair of the Institute for International Affairs of B'nai B'rith. He's just come back from a trip to the Middle East, and he's got some very interesting things to share with us, both as to the human suffering, the restrictions that the Israeli Defense Force are working under, and frankly, how the media is handling this in Canada, and particularly the Francophone media and what he's been through. Aaron, welcome, and thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Beryl.
Aaron, you gave a very compelling address recently at a rally in Montreal, where you outlined the human instructions, not military instructions, but the human instructions that Israeli commanders are given when they leave their defense briefing room and go out to battle. I'd like you to share some of those impressions with us.
Well, perhaps one of the most poignant moments was the remains of an Israeli soldier that was recovered. His parents, of course, had examined his remains after they came back from the Chevra Kadisha before burial. And in his personal belongings, they pulled
out... The Chevra Kadisha is the burial society.
Exactly, before...
Internment.
Before internment. And listening to a parent to say that, you know, I pulled out, okay, he had his lighter and he had his pen and he had his, you know, a couple of photographs of his girlfriend, but then he pulled out a card. And this is a card that's a laminated plastic card, and this is a card that every soldier carries with him. And it is the card that states the principles by which an Israeli soldier has to conduct themselves. And these are the principles of Talmudic and Jewish jurisprudence, which basically said, number one, the first thing, the first commandment, is Shmirat HaNefesh, and that is the maintaining of the dignity of human life. That is protecting the human life, and that is not protecting your life, because you're out there to sacrifice your life. That is to protect the life of your adversary. That is to only to take out the adversary who's trying to kill you, but not to take out innocent victims. And this is posted, this is taught, this is ingrained, this is part of the philosophy. Slightly different, I think, than the Islamo-fascist concepts of annihilating a whole people, a whole country, a whole society of a whole race, in other words.
And another thing that you pointed out, and that has been in some news media, but certainly not generally known, is that the frontline artillery units on the northern border are under instructions, cabinet instructions, not IDF general staff, that they are to fire only after there has been firing from the Hezbollah side. And many people don't know that. And that's part of all this concept.
Well, there's no question that in Israeli military doctrine, the question of preemptive strikes has always been an important aspect. But you're dealing here with a civilian-based enemy. You're dealing with a situation where you don't know, you can't really see who your enemy is. So you have to take those precautions. In the case of Kana, you already heard, and I don't have to repeat it, but in 1996 there was a similar situation where an errant shell landed in Kana, and at that time Shimon Peres was the leader. Of course, it was an errant shell. In this case, a specific attack was made on a specific target where jihadists were launching attacks against Israel. And again, unfortunately, innocent victims fell. And Israel has apologized for the innocent victims, but it has to continue to at least eradicate those which want to destroy on an intentional basis the innocent people of the state of Israel.
Aaron Reamer, stay with us. We're just going to pay some bills. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about how Israel treats its civilians and the million displaced versus what the Lebanese government is or is not doing for its own. Montreal, we'll be right back. We're back, and we're talking to Aaron Reamer, National Chair of the Institute for International Affairs of B'nai B'rith, on his recent trip to the Middle East. And Aaron, we were going to talk, I want a few of your impressions. There seems to be in the media almost a jealousy of the fact that Israel, which has 1.2 million citizens displaced, whole cities abandoned, and somehow nobody is focusing on that, but they're focusing on the fact that, and rightly so, on the displaced Lebanese civilians. But nobody's focusing on the fact of what the Israeli government and the Israeli people have done for their displaced co-citizens, while what Lebanon is not doing for theirs. You know, I'm staring at the leaflet that Israel has just thrown all over Lebanon from planes, hundreds of tens of millions of these leaflets which say, quote, to all citizens south of the Litani River, due to the terror activities being carried out against the state of Israel from within your villages and homes, the IDF is forced to respond immediately against these activities, even within your villages. For your safety, we call upon you to evacuate your villages and move north of the Litani River. This has been going on for 3 weeks for the, since the bombing started. And there's a real disconnect in the media between not focusing on what Israel is doing in its citizens in northern Israel and what Lebanon has failed to do to protect its citizens in the south. Can you comment on what you saw on the ground?
I will, but I would just want to preempt it with the statement that it's important to realize that there's a strong difference between the way that we are taught, and I say we, I refer to the Jewish community, that we are taught in terms of the sanctity of human life. We are not prepared to sacrifice human beings. We're not prepared to send out soldiers or...
That's not only the Jewish community, the Israeli community itself.
Yes.
We've seen Arab Muslim doctors hard at work at Rambam Hospital in Haifa, saving Jewish and non-Jewish lives.
Exactly. But what I'm trying to say is that we're not prepared to send out our innocent civilians with bomb belts to sacrifice in order to achieve a military goal. We're prepared to send our army, and our army is prepared to launch an attack, and it's prepared to take its losses, and it's prepared to do it from a non-residential, in a strictly military type of theater. You're dealing with a situation where the opposite is on the other side. So the concept of pikuach nefesh, the concept of the sanctity of human life, is something that is forever missing on the other side of the border. And so how do you deal with that? How do you fight a fair battle with an enemy who doesn't care about his own life and he doesn't care about the life of his child?
And another interesting aspect of the rules of engagement that the Israel Defense Forces is under that many people in the media do not focus on. It's been mentioned once or twice, but I want to mention it again, and I know this is close to your heart. When Israeli tank units go into a village, as they did in B'nai Jebel, they are not allowed to shell the village indiscriminately, even if they know that nobody's there except Hezbollah fighters. The soldiers have to get out of the bellies of the Merkava tanks. The companies have to come in, and they have to go street by street to engage. So this is a rule of engagement that the IDF has not had previously. It's very careful about that, and that's made it a little tough.
Well, that's exactly what caused Israel to suffer during the first Lebanon War, where basically they were caught in a guerrilla situation every day, trying to follow the rules of engagement, the Geneva Accords, the best of the possible way, and at the same time sacrificing soldiers in the interest of protecting innocent human lives.
Aaron, when you returned from your trip, I know you did a lot of media interviews. What were the highlights, but more important, where were you disappointed?
Well, I wasn't disappointed with most of the media interviews because I found that the interviewers generally were able to give me a fair opportunity. I have to say that my interview with Radio Canada was extremely, it was basically an ambush and a setup where I wasn't even given an opportunity to know who I would be speaking against. And then when I was told at the last minute, I wasn't given a chance for a rebuttal. And I found it extremely unfair. And basically, I find that certain aspects of the media tend to want to purvey a point of view, and they don't care about the facts and the information on the ground. But I do want to address your question about how...
Very briefly, Aaron, because we're in a hard break now.
Yes, I do want to address your question about how in Israel the population is protected and dealt with as opposed to in north of the border. We were...
Very briefly.
We were given the opportunity to meet with 300 or 400 Ethiopian children who were evacuated from their bombed-out absorption center. They greeted us in the central part of the country with dancing and dinner and laughing and happiness, and they were so ecstatic to know that a delegation came from North America to tell them that we care for you, that we support you, and that we're sorry that you've been separated from your parents. And I have to say, the Israeli country knows how to protect its citizens. It does it in an extremely proud and humble way, and it's only too bad that the Lebanese have not been able to gather around to come up to the challenge and to be able to protect its people.
The Lebanese government.
The Lebanese government and the Lebanese people in general. It's just terrible how they just let them stay in squalid refugee camps while we have taken and evacuated our refugees from every country in the world.
Aaron Reamer, I thank you very much for taking the time, and Montreal, we'll be right back right after this. Well, we go from the real blood and guts wars of the Middle East to the political wars of Canada. It's been a couple of weeks since we focused on the liberal leadership race, and sometimes you wonder if there is one. It's so sub rosa and sotto voce. But one thing struck me this week, and has struck our next guest for a number of weeks, the big to-do over Joe Volpe's candidacy. And today's lead editorial in the Gazette, its first paragraph is very on point. The turmoil in Joe Volpe's liberal leadership campaign reveals both the best and the worst of what's going on in the Liberal Party of Canada these days. I would just change that a bit to say the turmoil about Joe Volpe's liberal leadership campaign within the party reveals the best and the worst, and mostly the worst. This is a guy that everything he does, that every other candidate does, is blown out of all proportion. And Angelo Persichelli, thank you again for taking time out to be with us on a Sunday. Angelo is the Ottawa columnist for the Hill Times, and as I've said often, for my money, the gutsiest and most dead-on political reporter we've got in this country. Angelo, good morning. Good afternoon.
I am glad to be here with you this afternoon.
It's my pleasure. Why is it that everything about the Volpe campaign, he takes legal checks from some family that decides to issue them from two kids, like he's supposed to know, it's blown into a national issue. Carolyn Bennett calls him the elephant in the room. His campaign manager and him have a disagreement on a policy question about the Middle East. The campaign manager quits because he doesn't like Volpe's pro-Israel stand. All of a sudden, that's a major headline. What is it about Joe Volpe that's threatening everybody?
Well, it has nothing to do with Joe Volpe. As you said, it has to do with the Liberal Party.
Can they only function by smears and innuendos again?
Well, whatever bad or good is in the Volpe campaign, it's not Volpe's campaign. Whatever Joe Volpe knows, he learned within the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party is a party that has used the ethnic communities as a pawn, as used the ethnic communities as a folkloristic panorama behind the leaders, and that's exactly what they want. But as soon as anyone from ethnic community that in Quebec, I think they say allophone, whatever is not francophone.
Yes, allophone,
or
very popular term.
Yes, and it's not francophone or anglophone, then all of a sudden becomes bad. I want to make just a distinction. When I say anglophone or francophones, I don't mean the people in the street, the Joe Blows or whatever. They know what Canada is all about. When I say anglophones, I mean the people, media, I mean the politicians, and they are trying to grab to the power. They do everything to hold the power and trying to keep the so-called allophones or whatever you want to call them out of the power. But it has nothing to do with the anglophone, the Anglo people, the Franco people on the street. They know. They leave. They leave multiculturalism. They leave this country. They know who Canada, what Canada is all about. So when I say francophones or anglophones, I want to qualify that. I mean some journalists, some politicians that they are trying to use, especially the liberals and all the media that is supporting the Liberal Party, they are used the ethnics to do whatever they had in mind to do.
You know,
I just want to make one point. Without the ethnics, they are finished. In 1984, when John Turner, we know when they had the election, they were saved by the ethnics in Toronto,
yes,
and Montreal. Otherwise, they would have been a party of two, just like the Conservatives. And even now, when we see that the Liberal Party is still strong in urban areas, and look at the coincidence, because in the urban areas, there are ethnics, there are people that are not Anglophone or Francophone, and they are supporting the Liberal Party. But they have to be very careful, because they are playing a very dangerous card at this time, because whenever there is something wrong, look at the sponsorship scandal.
I was about to say, Angelo, you know, you and I may be the most politically incorrect Canadians left, but, you know, it's sad that you're saying this, and I think it's true, and that's why it's sad, because this has been a week in Quebec, you alluded to the allophones, where we have francophone media talk show hosts, for example. Forget about their political views on the Middle East crisis, but the way they describe it, terms are used in many shows. Les Juifs, never les Israéliens. It's always the Libanais. We've had a very terrible incident on the South Shore in a Longue bar where a bar refused admission to black customers. And now what you're underlining as the basis for this, the Volpe madness in the Liberal Party, I'm afraid is true, isn't it?
Well,
this is not the great vertical mosaic of John Porter.
No, absolutely. Definitely it's not with the Liberals. Look at that. I was mentioning the sponsorship scandal.
Can you hold a thought for a Montreal, we're back, and we're talking with Hill Times, Ottawa Hill Times columnist Angelo Persichelli, Canada's most perspicacious political commentator. I couldn't resist that, Angelo, on the liberal leadership wars. And we were talking about the underlying current in this country of still the ruling elites not being quite comfortable with what in Quebec are called les autres.
Not at all. They are not comfortable, and they do everything they can to stop it. Look at what Carolyn Bennett said about Volpe accusing him of being an elephant in the room. An elephant, keeping in mind that he has done whatever he has done for all other leaders, for John Turner, for Jean Chrétien, for Paul Martin, as well as Jim Karajanis. And guess what? The first one, according to the media, the first one with more more delegates and more support.
I found that really strange. She was complaining that he had signed up so many.
That's the point, isn't it? Gerard Kennedy, that is completely new to the federal party and is on the top, according to the Toronto Star, everything is normal. And she's complaining about bullying the other candidates when the most bullying activity we saw was with Paul Martin, and she was one of the strongest support of Paul Martin. The campaign, well, Paul Martin's campaign.
Yes, who can forget her crying one day when Jean Chrétien said something to her and Paul Martin came over and hugged her?
Yeah, they kicked out, they killed any other candidate, John Manley, Sheila Copps. Very strong candidates were kicked out, were excluded from the race, and she was silent. In fact, she was supporting Paul Martin. Now she's saying that there is an elephant in the room because it's Joe Volpe. Now, with all those things, when they...
Yet all the big money guys, according to the Hill Times list that's published every week of supporters, all the huge money guys, the corporate guys, are lining up behind other candidates.
Yeah, and you know what? There is another point I want to make. I was reading on this editorial on the Gazette when they talk about the fight of being or getting the list of the delegates or the supporters. That's the basic for every organization. A. Two, if someone doesn't work with any organization, right after he's not part of the organization and has no access to the computers. And three, they always, and this is very despicable to read this on the Montreal Gazette, because they believe that people go amongst ethnic communities and they have the people signing because they are sheeped, and you know, sheepishly they write every paper that's in front of them. This is very offensive, because the people, if they sign up, they know exactly what they want to do. They want to support the people that respect them, and the Liberal Party is not supporting, it's not respecting them. And I hope that in Montreal they wake up. There are many, many people of Italian origin, Greek, Jewish community. I hope that they wake up and they see what the Liberal Party has done to them and keeps doing to them, takes their vote, and as soon as someone goes right or tries to go on the top, they just kill it.
Now, Angelo, tell us how you really feel. Don't hold back. But I'll tell you something that you're right about. You know, I give a talk every 10 days or so across the island, and I'm noticing in Italian writings, in Jewish writings, there's a wave and vague, as we call it in Quebec, of real resentment. Of being taken for granted. You're dead on right. There's real resentment out there.
I'm not telling people who they have to vote for. They have to vote for people that respect them. And wherever they find them, they should vote for them. The only thing I can say at the present time, now we see the true colors. Liberal Party has never respected them.
Angelo Persichelli, many thanks for taking the time to be with us.
My pleasure.
Take care. Well, that was the Liberal leadership wars and the massaging of political messages. There's another kind of massaging of messages. Mark Twain once said there's three kinds of lies. Lies, damn lies, and statistics. And our next guest is a remarkable writer, Dan Gardner of the Ottawa Citizen, who talks to us about what the crime statistics don't tell us. That there's a parallel that's impossible to miss. That crime trends are not driven by criminal justice policies. They're just knee-jerk reactions to what politicians think people want to hear. And he says, don't expect to hear this from the partisans of the left or the right, because they use the same kind of messages that you just heard Angelo Persichelli talking about the Liberal Party using to get votes to get their constituencies behind them. Dan Gardner, welcome. Thanks for taking the time. I know you're out in God's country on vacation.
Glad to do it.
Thanks very much. Dan, this was a very compelling article you wrote. How does it, and relates directly, I think, in large part, to the new omnibus justice bill that's been produced with mandatory minimums. How do you feel about that? Is that just a response to sort of knee-jerk reaction from a public that doesn't understand about corrections policy?
Well, you know, I mean, when it comes to crime and criminal justice, I have to say, I got into this research about 6-7 years ago and started into it pretty heavily at that point. And I was shocked by what I found, by what the research showed, because what people believe... Hello?
Yes, I hear you.
Oh, okay, I've got a dial tone there. But what people, what the difference is between the, what the research shows and what the reality and what people believe about crime is pretty profound. There's a huge gap, and unfortunately, politicians have capitalized on the gap. They play to the gap. They play to the gap in knowledge, and they ignore what the proper research shows.
What's the biggest issue now where they've managed to maneuver statistics to suit political expediency?
Well, the latest, I would say the most successful element of that, of course, is the Harper government. The Harper government...
Sorry, you're breaking up there a bit.
Oh, okay.
Okay, we hear you now.
Okay. The Harper government has, as of course, is one of its five priorities, crack down on crime. We're going to get tough on crime. And, of course, to justify that priority, to make people find this attractive, they have to get out the message that crime is on the rise, that things are getting worse, that there's mayhem in the streets, etc. And they've done that by very selectively quoting statistics, or they've done it by ignoring the statistics altogether and simply repeating this assertion that somehow crime is getting worse in defiance of all the evidence. And so that's number one.
Dan, can you hold number two? I got to pay a bill, and we'll be right back with you.
Sure.
Thanks. Montreal, we're back. We're talking with the Ottawa Citizens, Dan Gardner, on how governments massage crime statistics to fit their political agendas. And we were just getting into a second point that Dan wanted to make. But, Dan, I hope you don't mind. We've got Reverend Darrell Gray, one of Montreal's leading community activists, joining us on the line. And I know that he's got a lot of interest in what you've got to say, so welcome, Reverend Gray.
Well, thank you very much.
Brother Darrell, you finally made it. Get close to your phone and listen to Dan Gardner. Dan, what was the second point you were going to make?
Yeah, the second point I was going to make was simply this. Point number one is that the government has attempted to get out the message that crime is on the increase, that the sky is falling, and so on. And the second point is that the government is saying, well, we have the solution. The solution is tougher punishments. And that's just wrong. That's just flat-out wrong. There's endless research to indicate that that actually does not affect crime. It will not make our streets safer.
And the reason I wanted to bring Darrell Gray into this conversation, Dan, and is because that message, there is something to subliminal seduction, isn't there, Darrell?
Well, I mean... Yeah,
when that message goes out from a government, then communities of visible minorities, communities of color, communities of ethnicity, they get affected by it in nasty ways sometimes.
Well, visible minorities become more visible. The whole idea of racial profiling becomes a lot more prevalent. And I agree totally with what your speaker is saying.
Dan Gardner.
As far as the statistics, and they are skewed, and I agree 100% that they are for political motivation, and they do absolutely nothing at all for the community. You get more prisons built, but he's absolutely right. Pumping money into enforcement does nothing at all for prevention, and I think that that's really the way to go with government monies anyway.
And Dan, you know, we heard the cost after what mandatory minimums would mean to Canada. It would mean two new prisons, $245 million, an increase in the prison population of from Stockwell Day, 12,900 today to 19,700.
Mm-hmm.
Don't we really need that money spent to have visible deterrence, even in hardcore neighborhoods?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that those numbers, I don't trust those numbers. I actually have earlier documents from studies by federal civil servants which indicate that, in fact, the conservative platform, if it were all implemented, would actually increase the prison population considerably more than that, and the cost of prisons would actually be in the billions of dollars, not the hundreds of millions. Second, that's number one. And number two, yes, I mean, if you're going to ask yourself, okay, what do we want to do for our communities? Do we want to make them safer? Do we want, you know, we want safe streets? We want these good things. Well, the first thing to do is stop and take a look at the research. And when the research shows you over and over and over and over again that something doesn't work, don't do it.
Not only does it not work, but the stress on violent crime is I think, misplaced. And Darrell, I want to turn to you because we cannot be satisfied with a political culture or a national culture that is so scared every time little Johnny falls off his bike, but when a black man walks into a bar in Longueuil, the Longueuil bar owners get hit with a slap on the wrist. We cannot be satisfied with a Canadian culture that doesn't understand that crimes of prejudice are more prevalent than crimes of violence. Is that not true?
No, that is true. But the thing, I mean, when you talk about the Longay Barnes situation, is racism plus economics. When you tie economics into racism or racism into economics, I mean, you could talk about the bar, but you could also talk about what Dan is saying with the prisons. You build more prisons. There was a movement a few years ago to privatize a lot of the prisons. You're talking about a reality in this country and the U.S. where you're talking about when you privatize prisons, when you make prisons more commercial, then you're not looking at rehabilitation. You look at warehousing, and then you look at the money that goes into doing this.
You're not talking about correction. You're talking about coercion.
Exactly. And even the bar owner, I mean, he said, well, there are too many blacks. And we had this problem in Nova Scotia where the bar owner...
What does that mean, there's too many blacks? What does it mean? If a bar's got a lot of francophones, there's too many francophones? No. Too many anglophones?
No, but what their argument has always been is that the blacks will come in, they'll buy a drink, and they'll buy a beer, and they'll walk around. And their argument was whites will come in, and they'll buy three drinks, and they'll stay for a while. And that was their issue. Their issue, they said, was an issue of economics, but we found that that was not the case. It was an issue of racism. It was not economics at all.
Dan Gardner, closing comment, very short. Daryl, to you too. Are we ever going to be able to get a justice message across that we are building a society that values compassion and coercion and cooperation over competition and coercion, or is this just going to be politics as usual?
Well, look.
Very briefly.
People just have to demand of a politician when they suggest they have a solution in hand, say, I want the research, I want the evidence, and I want the proof.
I agree
with Dan, and I think that Dan was right. I think that we need to start looking at the reasons. We want to put a lot of money into what we say is the problem, but we're not looking at what is causing the problem. Until we start putting more money into the cause of crime, then we'll continue to have crime, and politicians will continue to do what many politicians do, not all of them, and that's look out for their own personal partisan interests.
Reverend Daryl Gray, Dan Gardner of the Ottawa Citizen, thank you both very much. Thank you, Jesse Connell, our operator, Val Prudnikoff, our producer, Montreal. We'll see you next time.